From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, China says no links to terrorism among Chinese passengers. China splits with Russia over Ukraine. Jakarta governor's presidential nomination shakes up Indonesian politics. These stories and more on this Wednesday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. The search is now 11 days old, but military personnel from 26 countries appear to be no closer to finding the missing Malaysian passenger jet. Malaysian authorities say the search for the Boeing 777 airliner with 239 people aboard has been expanded to cover more than 7 million square kilometers. That's an area about the size of Australia and extends from Central Asia in the north to the vast waters of the Indian Ocean to the south. Thailand's military released new radar information Tuesday that could support earlier reports that the Malaysia Airlines jet made a sharp turn to the west toward the Strait of Malacca after its last contact was recorded early March 8th north of Malaysia. The Thai government said its radar detected a plane that may have been missing Flight 370, but initially paid little attention to the jet because it was not a threat to its security. Meanwhile, Chinese authorities say they have found no links to terrorism in their review of all 153 Chinese nationals on board the missing Malaysian flight. VOA's Bill Ide has more from Beijing.
China says it has deployed 21 satellites to help in the effort to find the vanished Boeing 777 commercial airliner that continues to baffle investigators and leave the family members of those on board increasingly desperate for answers. Chinese authorities say they are searching a corridor of China's southwestern territory for any signs of the plane. It is believed the jet could have headed in a northwesterly direction up through Burma, China, and as far as Kazakhstan, or taken a southwesterly arc to the Indian Ocean. Investigators believe the plane was deliberately diverted, but by whom and for what purpose remains unclear. For its part, China's ambassador to Malaysia, Huang Huikang, told reporters in Kuala Lumpur Tuesday that there is nothing to suggest the Chinese passengers on the flight were to blame. Huang says China has investigated the backgrounds of all the Chinese passengers on board the missing flight and has found no evidence suggesting they are linked to destructive behavior on the aircraft. He says because of that, we can rule out suspicion that Chinese passengers are linked to a terror attack or destructive activities on the missing plane. In their quest to find more answers about what may have happened to the plane, investigators are looking into the backgrounds of all of those on board, including the flight's captain, co-pilot, and crew. Authorities say that whomever took control of the plane had a deep knowledge of the jet and its systems. Ambassador Huang says experts and security officials from China have been helping out with the investigation since shortly after the plane went missing in the early hours of March 8th. However, what China's review of its radar data has uncovered remains unclear. Publicly reviewing radar data has already proven to be a particularly touchy process because it can reveal countries' air defense capabilities. Shortly after MH370 took off from Kuala Lumpur, investigators believe someone on board turned off equipment that identifies the plane to civilian radar. Malaysian military radar tracked an unidentified plane back across the peninsula, but no effort was made to confirm whether it was flight MH370. It was not until a week later when Malaysian authorities confirmed that the unidentified plane was the missing jet. From the area off Malaysia's west coast, it is believed the plane could have flown either north or south. James Nolte, a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute, says that like most developed countries, China has air defense radar that can detect planes at mid to high altitude. He says that it is very hard for a plane to approach at that altitude and go unnoticed.
However, radar follows straight lines. So if a plane is flying very, very low, especially in an area that's mountainous, for example, then the radar will be blocked and wouldn't necessarily be able to detect a low-flying plane, particularly if it were following, in the shadow of mountains or terrain obstacles like that.
Mountain ranges in southern China could provide such cover for a plane to fly into the country's airspace undetected, but Nolt says he believes it's unlikely the plane could have done that without someone noticing.
Because most countries in the region have fairly sophisticated radar systems and air defense systems, I would be somewhat surprised if the airplane flew for any distance over land. I think my own belief is it's more likely that it suffered some mishap over the ocean because it would be less likely to be detected if its flight paths were primarily over the ocean.
26 countries are involved in the search, which now includes water and land in 11 countries and spans more than 7 million square kilometers. Australia says it has narrowed its search somewhat based on new satellite data and water movements in the southern Indian Ocean. The area it is searching in, however, is still roughly the size of Spain and Portugal combined. Bill Eyde, VOA News, Beijing.
Malaysian opposition leader Anwar Ibrahim is rejecting what he calls a desperate attempt to link him to the disappearance of Malaysia Airlines Flight 370. Several recent reports suggesting the missing plane's pilot, Captain Zahari Ahmad Shah, was an active member of Anwar's opposition People's Justice Party. Speculation about Zahari's involvement in the plane's disappearance intensified after Malaysian authorities said the jet was likely deliberately diverted. Some foreign media reports suggested Zahari hijacked the plane because he was angry about Anwar's sodomy conviction, which occurred just hours before the plane took off. Our weekly poll is at voanews.com/daybreakasia, and it's currently asking, where do you think that Malaysian Airlines flight will be found? So far, and down slightly, 36% of those responding think the plane will be found in the ocean, while a little up to 18% shows that the plane will end up on an island. 23% are looking at a location toward inland Asia, and up by the most 3%, 15% say the plane will never be found, while almost 7% are not sure. It's not a scientific poll, but an interesting reflection of what our audience is thinking as the search for Malaysian Airlines 370 is in its second full week. You can make your choice at voanews.com/daybreakasia. With Russia's most vocal critics imposing economic sanctions over Crimea, some of Moscow's allies are also questioning its actions in Ukraine. VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns reports on how the standoff affects Russia's relations with China and with former Soviet republics.
In Syria's civil war, China and Russia have together blocked tougher action against President Bashar al-Assad, denouncing foreign support for the rebels as a breach of Syrian sovereignty. But China has quietly split from Russia over Crimea on the same issue of sovereignty. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Hong Lei.
China always respects the sovereignty and territorial integrity of all states. The Crimean crisis should be resolved politically under the frameworks of law and order. We call on all sides to remain calm and exercise restraint to avoid further escalation of the tension.
China wants nothing that might encourage separatist tensions, making Crimea a costly move for Russia, says American University professor Keith Darden.
China has a very strict anti-secession, one China policy. It requires international support for its positions on Taiwan. The idea that by popular referendum, some part of the country could decide that it's no longer part of the country without the approval of the central government is something they are never going to sign on to. So Russia is isolating itself by this action.
When Russia vetoed a draft UN Security Council resolution on Crimea, China abstained, saying more should be done to de-escalate the crisis. U.S. officials say they're consulting closely with China on Ukraine, trying to further isolate Russia by portraying its actions in Crimea as outside international norms. U.S. State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki.
Well, our hope continues to be that, you know, many members of the international community, including China, are in coordination and cooperation about the illegal steps that Russia took in this case and the pressure that needs to be exerted from not just the United States, but countries around the world.
Russian troops taking charge in a former Soviet republic also raises questions about whether Moscow will maintain the post-Cold War status quo.
Kazakhstan, for example, is absolutely alarmed by the idea that Russian-speaking populations should have the right to determine whether they would secede and become part of the Russian Federation. Within the Commonwealth of Independent States, Russia has been enshrining the principle of sovereignty, and that's partly why it has had good relations with Kazakhstan and some of its neighbors. Undoing that is going to cause a lot of havoc in those relations.
President Vladimir Putin says Russia is not to blame for the crisis in Crimea, and he's called an early April meeting of the post-Soviet Commonwealth of Independent States to discuss the crisis in Ukraine. Scott Stearns, VOA News, at the State Department.
The new U.S. ambassador to China, Max Baucus, has begun his job by stressing the importance of the U.S.-China relationship. Shannon Van Sant reports from Beijing.
Less than 24 hours after landing in Beijing to take up his new job, Ambassador Max Baucus told reporters Monday he would push for an improvement in ties between the two countries.
The United States-China relationship is one of America's most important bilateral relationships, and it will shape global affairs for generations to come. We simply must get it right. I was very honored when the president called me, asked me to take this job. One of the main reasons I accepted is because I want to be part of helping manage this relationship in the very best possible way.
He succeeds Gary Locke, who stressed human rights in his farewell speech, during which he said China's development depends on rule of law, an independent judiciary, and freedom of speech. Baucus, a former U.S. senator, says strengthening economic ties is his top priority, but that he will urge Beijing to support the laws, norms, values, and human rights that support the international system. The United States has sought China's cooperation on a number of issues, including efforts to end North Korea's nuclear weapons program and to end the Syrian civil war. But the two governments have often had conflicts, including over China's increasingly territorial claims in the South China Sea and over economic policy. Baucus said the U.S.-China relationship requires sustained, high-level engagement.
Leaders on both sides have recognized that we have much more to gain from cooperation than from conflict.
Chinese news media have welcomed Ambassador Baucus's arrival in Beijing, with one editorial in the state-run China Daily newspaper proclaiming he can bring China to the U.S. Congress. Shannon Van Sant for VOA News, Beijing.
Another American is heading to China, U.S. First Lady Michelle Obama. She leaves Wednesday for a visit from March 20th through the 26th. The White House says that the First Lady will focus on education and stay away from controversial issues. VOA's Yang Chen has more on this report, narrated by Colin Lovett.
Ben Rhodes, Deputy National Security Advisor for Strategic Communications, told reporters that Michelle Obama's visit to China will focus on people-to-people relations and education, not on controversial issues like human rights, trade, and counterfeiting.
We don't think that the First Lady should make this a focus at all of her trip. This is a very different purpose. This is the purpose, again, of building those people-to-people connections, of reaching out to young people in China, of broadening the ties between our two countries.
She is scheduled to give at least two speeches on education and visit a school accompanied by China's First Lady, Peng Liyuan. Tina Chen, Mrs. Obama's chief of staff, said the U.S. First Lady will use her own story to illustrate the power of education,
which we think resonates with young people around the world. How someone from a modest background whose parents didn't go to college, but who emphasized education always to the First Lady and her brother, encouraged them to use education as a way to succeed and move forward.
Chen said the First Lady will be posting blogs and travel information for each step of her trip on the website, whitehouse.gov. Analysts say the trip is intended to help soften U.S.-China relations. Center for Strategic and International Studies Senior Advisor for Asia, Bonnie Glaser, thinks the trip will be helpful to the bilateral relationship.
So this kind of visit can help to build public support so that people think that the U.S.-China relationship is important, that their highest leaders and spouses do care very much about the relationship. And I think that the at least arresting this negative trend that we have seen in the attitudes of American and Chinese publics.
This will be Michelle Obama's third official overseas trip without her husband. For Yang Chen, I'm Colin Lovett, VOA News.
The rise of Jakarta Governor Joko Widodo, a former furniture retailer from the small town in Java, has become something of a political phenomenon in Indonesia. A relative outsider in a system dominated by political elites, many say Widodo is likely to be Indonesia's next president. From Jakarta, Kate Lamb has more.
Even before it was certain he would run for president, Joko Widodo, known widely here by his nickname Jokowi, has dominated opinion polls for months. Dubbed the Jokowi effect, the current Jakarta governor is so popular that when it was confirmed just days ago that he would contest the July presidential election, the rupiah hit a 19-week high. In a society deeply divided by extremes of wealth, racked by corruption, and where politicians rarely mix with the populace outside election time, Mr. Widodo's approach is unique. The 52-year-old politician is known for his down-to-earth style and has become famous for blusukan, his habit of impromptu spot checks that keep government officials wary. Andy Bayuni, a senior editor at the Jakarta Post, says the governor's approach has captured the imagination of Indonesian voters.
I think most of all, it's his personal character. You know, he comes across as someone who is humble, low-profile, honest, qualities that seem to be lacking among most of our politicians. And I think people like that.
The world's third largest democracy will go to the polls more than once this year, first in the parliamentary elections this April, and then in July for the subsequent presidential vote. To nominate a presidential candidate, a party or a coalition of parties must win at least 25% of the national vote in the April ballot. Announcing Joko Widodo's presidential nomination last Friday afternoon, Megawati Sukarnoputri, the head of the Democratic Party of Struggle, executed brilliant political timing. Following months of intense speculation, the party is now expected to draw at least 30% in the parliamentary vote. Douglas Ramage, a senior analyst with Bauer Group Asia, says Jokowi's clean record speaks volumes.
And he's also overwhelmingly perceived as honest and sincere, which voters say is the number one quality they're looking for in a candidate. So I think the voters have been very consistent for the past decade. So for the past decade, in almost all the surveys of what voters are most looking for in a candidate, they're putting transparency, good governance, and anti-corruption at the top of the list.
The governor's biggest contender is Prabowo Subianto, a former army general accused of human rights abuses in East Timor, who is currently banned from travelling to the United States. Other candidates include wealthy businessman Aburizal Bakri and Wiranto, another former general. As campaign season intensifies, each presidential candidate is working to present themselves as a common man of the people. But in reality, many have strong ties to the old regime. Artian Pratomo from the independent group Solo Kota Kita says that Widodo prioritised the needs of the most vulnerable long before he thought about becoming president. As Solo mayor, Widodo introduced basic health care and education for the poor and placed a strong emphasis on community consultation.
Actually, he only doing that the small thing, but that small thing is the principal part of the whole idea. Only small thing, but the implication, the impact is very big because he's doing with the humanistic method.
As head of the Jakarta administration for the past 18 months, Widodo has also earned praise for pragmatism and early efforts to revamp a desperately overrun metropolis. But despite his popularity, there are many unknowns. The governor's grassroots approach might not work for the president's office. And constituents know little of what he stands for at the national level.
We don't know how familiar he is with the economic challenges Indonesia face. We don't know what is his foreign policy. We don't know how he views the strategic security interests of Indonesia. So there's so many question marks about Jokowi, but I think people are willing to take the chance.
15 years after the fall of dictator Suharto, the 2014 election will be the third time Indonesia democratically chooses its president. A total of 186.5 million people are registered to vote in this year's elections. For VOA News, this is Kate Lam, Jakarta.
Our weekly look at education sees a proposal to change California's law against affirmative action being put aside. Daybreak Asia's Ira Melman reports the move was prompted by strong pressure applied by a good portion of California's Asian American community.
STSI! No, no, no! STSI! No!
Protests like this were held throughout the state of California, members of the state's sizable Asian American community voicing their displeasure over SCA 5, a proposed state constitutional amendment that would have amended parts of what is known as Proposition 209. Also known as California's Civil Rights Initiative, it prohibits state government institutions from considering race, sex, or ethnicity, specifically in the areas of public employment, public contracting, or public education. It is education that has drawn the protest. If approved by voters, SCA 5, introduced by State Senator Ed Hernandez, would have changed the law to permit California state colleges and universities to admit greater numbers of minority applicants. However, California voters will not vote on SCA 5, at least this year. Although the measures did pass the state Senate, it will not be brought to a vote by the California Assembly. John Perez is the Speaker of the Assembly.
Senator Hernandez and I met, and at his request, I will be returning SCA 5 to the Senate without our action, and we'll be calling for the creation of a nonpartisan bicameral task force to deal with issues related to broad-based access to higher education.
Perez says the task force will include both lawmakers and academics to find ways to expand access to higher education in California. The Asian American protest was centered on what the protesters perceived as quotas, which the amendment would place on college admissions. Marina See is a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Department of Education. She claims SCA 5 would create racial division.
It's a great potential to hurt those who work hard, who wanted to go to UC. And now, if we use quota, then it's already over a lot of complaint to me as an educator myself that why am I not being admitted, and then because why the Hispanic population would be, they perform maybe less or this and that, and then I am not being admitted.
However, SCA sponsor Senator Ed Hernandez told VOA last week before the decision not to proceed with the legislation that quotas are not part of the proposal.
It's all about one thing. It's about equal opportunity for everyone, even an equal opportunity amongst Chinese Americans. Unfortunately, it's created a lot of controversy because there's a lot of misinformation out there. But it's all about equal opportunity.
When you say information out there that shouldn't be out there, to what do you refer?
Well, I mean, we're getting a lot of calls, and the calls are based on people think that there's going to be quota systems. Keep in mind that the Supreme Court held that quotas are unconstitutional and illegal, so that's not going to happen. And what they're also saying is that their kids aren't going to get accepted to schools and going to be replaced by someone else. That is not the case. All kids in the state of California from all ethnicities are going to be accepted based on the merits.
According to the Pew Research Center, Hispanics make up the largest segment of California's population, estimated at 39%. Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders make up only 13% of the population, but make up more than 35% of students entering California state colleges. Senator Hernandez says he will wait until the task force has completed its work and that there is what he calls robust and constructive debate about how to improve and expand opportunities in California's higher education system. At that time, SCA 5 presumably could again start to make its way toward a vote. Ira Melman, VOA News, Washington.
Our program may be drawing to a close, but you can continue to stay with us on our Facebook page at VOA Asia. Be sure to like us, and you'll like spending a little time with Steve Norman and catching up on the latest world news. He's next with International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for joining us today on Daybreak Asia.